This week, we ask a hard question. Do you have enough positive male influence in your life? Brother Harrison stops by in an all-new Masonic Minute. We get the scoop on the first artificer of metals. Then we get some insights into what the Mason of the 1970s thought about Masonic education. Finally, we wrap it with a segment about the first World's Fair and the Masons that made it possible. Don't miss it.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode 442. We've got some great stuff coming up for you this week. I hope you're all staying safe, staying clean, all of those things, and that this isn't impacting you negatively for all those out there who are dealing with the pandemic. During this time of crisis, of course, we are foregoing any and all adverts, so a thank you goes out to all of our supporters, whether you're a fellow, a contributor, or a producer, or you're just a one-time contributor to the program. I want to thank you for allowing us to bring this program to you guys week after week. And if you're interested in becoming a supporter of the program, head on over to WCYpodcast.com where you can check all that stuff out. I wanted to mention a couple updates happening with Masonic cons across the world. It seems like there's some pivots that are being made in terms of going digital. I do know that the Masonic con, which was scheduled for Boston, which was supposed to be last weekend, but that has a pivot. Now that's going to be at the end of August. I've not heard any updates on EsoterraCon yet, so far that is, as far as I know, still happening. We may see a pivot there as well. I'm not sure yet. MasonicCon Chicago. This is another big one, but this is happening in September, toward the mid-end of September, and so far we are still on. We will, of course, be taking measures to ensure all the safety that we can implement, but if a digital pivot is needed, we will do it, and we will be ready to go for that. So no worries either way. It's still going to be amazing. All right, so the first piece that I have for you guys this week is something that was actually published all the way back in 2018 by Brother Darren A. Lehners, and it's The Importance of Being a Role Model. Now, this was recently featured in the Fraternal Review magazine, and I wanted to go ahead and read it for you here on the show. And if you're interested in more from the Fraternal Review, head on over to theresearchlodge.com. The Importance of Being a Role Model by Midnight Freemason contributor, Worshipful Brother Darren A. Lehners. Todd Creason recently wrote a wonderful article about the importance of having a good reputation. You can find it at the web address listed below. What he said below really got me thinking. Quote, "Men of good reputation and solid character used to be more common than they are today. We don't teach the value of it anymore. Our society is focused inward on ourselves and our own selfish needs. We are a society of grown children fighting and arguing on social media just like children used to fight and argue in the playground. We've never grown up and become men because we haven't had the role models. And just like children, we don't think about what we're saying, and we don't think about what our words and actions are saying about us." End quote. It made me think about a few quotes from one of my favorite books and later movie. Quote, "I see in Fight Club the strongest and smartest men who've ever lived. I see all this potential and I see squandering. An entire generation pumping gas, waiting tables, slaves with white collars. Advertising has us chasing cars and clothes, working jobs we hate so we can buy shit we don't need. And we're the middle children of history, man. No purpose or place. We have no great war, no great depression. Our great war is a spiritual war. Our great depression is our lives. We've been all raised by television to believe that one day we'll all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars, but we won't. And we're slowly learning that fact, and we're very, very pissed off." End quote. And, quote, "We're a generation of men raised by women. I'm wondering if another woman is really the answer we need." End quote. Chuck Palahniuk, Fight Club. Our role models have been TV stars, movie stars, rock stars, and sports stars. We've been raised through television. I was what was called a latchkey kid. Mom and Dad both worked, so I'd get off the school bus, walk home, turn on the television. It was my babysitter. With the advent of cable television in the early mid-1980s, I would watch MTV. I would see images of rock stars behaving like children. There were videos with drinking, partying to excess. The sexual exploitation of both women and men was rampant. I was lucky enough to understand at a young age that it was just fantasy, but still, I wonder what type of effect it had. I was, and still am, lucky enough to have both parents. But many of my friends come from broken homes, where mom or dad was left to work two or three jobs. Mom or dad was absent. In most cases, 84% were raised by single moms. A large percentage of our teachers were female also. I went to a Catholic grade school, so from K through 8, I had no male teachers. The first male teacher I had was in high school. I didn't really have any male role models to look to. Also, my dad didn't want to play with my brother and me after work. He wanted to come home, have a few beers, and unwind. I love my dad. I don't fault him for that. Plus, he probably had a hard time relating to me. Although he was a role model, I liked things he didn't understand. I used to go to a place in Bradley, Illinois called Castle Hobbies. I'd meet my friends there and we'd play Dungeons & Dragons or Warhammer 40K and other various miniature or role-playing games that were being played. My dad didn't understand the point of it all. He'd tell me this on many occasions. I think that he understood that I was off the streets and not spending the money I had on drugs or alcohol. Although he did wonder why I was spending it on polyhedral dice. My generation has been bombarded with 40 to 50 plus years of targeted advertising that teaches happiness equals stuff. We are conditioned to believe that success is a measurement of what you own, not who you are. The size of your house, the clothes you wear, and the type of car you drive are all indications of how, quote-unquote, successful you are. We've been taught to consume, consume, consume. As Fight Club asks, do you know what a duvet is? It's a blanket. Just a blanket. Now, why do guys like you and me know what a duvet is? Is this essential to our survival in the hunter-gatherer sense of the world? No. What are we then? We are consumers. We're the byproducts of a lifestyle obsession. End quote. Couple this with many of us not having a real male role model growing up. Is it any wonder we're all angry and selfish children? I was lucky to have some male role models in scouting. They, coupled with my dad's apathy towards volunteering, made me want to be a volunteer soccer coach for my son's teams. And also, to be a scout leader. It was through scouting that I met fellow Midnight Freemason Greg Knott. Greg Knott often jokes about him giving me structure, but he's not half wrong. Freemasonry came along for me when I was at a crossroads. You see, I was one of those selfish grown children that Todd referenced. I won't get into details, but Greg saw something untapped in me that I didn't recognize. He saw potential. He reached out to me. He told me about how Freemasonry promotes many of Scouting's ideas. He helped to set me on a path that has changed my life. Forever. It was through Greg that I met Todd Creason. I slowly got more involved in helping them both with their mission to restore Homer Lodge number 199. They both have become not just great mentors, but really good friends, all because Greg took a chance on me. There has long been a notion within Freemasonry that we make good men better. I would argue that this is false. First of all, we're not just accepting good men. Every year at Grand Lodge, when the roll call of brothers being expelled for committing a felony is read, I'm reminded that we need to do a better job of guarding the West Gate. Secondly, we hardly go out of our way to make men better. How many times do we bring in a candidate only to have him attend Lodge a few times and then never return? Now, I will say some of this is on the individual brother, but most of it is on us. You see, we are failing each other even in Lodge. The idea of making someone better implies that someone is doing the teaching. Like I stated, I was lucky. I had a Masonic role model to emulate when I joined the Lodge, but not everyone is as lucky. We as Masons also need role models. Now, I'm sure if you're reading this article, you can probably think immediately who you consider a Masonic mentor or role model. If you're like me, you have several. But are you a mentor or role model to someone else? Are you going out of your way to make new brothers feel welcomed? Are you helping them with ritual? Are you answering their questions as they come up? You see, we have an untapped market of men that we can reach. There are now a few generations of men that would benefit from having a role model. We need to step up to the task. How do we do this? I think it's pretty simple, really. Guard the West Gate. We need to admit men that are going to actively participate in Freemasonry. Admitting everyone who has a pulse isn't going to help our issues. We're just going to spend more time chasing after late dues payments. Identify good men and make them your priority. Dress education. We need to structure our business meetings around education. Get good speakers from the community, Masonic and otherwise, to address topics that men care about. Eliminate the waste from the business meetings. Bills can be auto-deducted. The treasurer's reports can be emailed, as can the secretary's minutes and announcements. Cut out what you can and keep only the essentials. Be an exemplar. Let your actions speak louder than your words. Don't engage in things that could soil your reputation or that of the fraternity, especially on social media. Be a mentor. Take new members under your wings. Meet with them outside of lodge. Address their questions and concerns. Listen to their ideas. Teach others how to be a mentor. This is self-explanatory. Pay it forward. Teach the men you mentor how to be mentors. Do things outside of the lodge as a group. Last, but certainly not least, organize fun events for your members and their families. The events can be informal or formal. Look, it's going to take a tremendous amount of effort to get to where we need to be. It might not even happen in my lifetime. I believe in this fraternity. I believe that we all can make a world a better place for ourselves and our families. Yes, it's going to take work. We all need to pitch in. We should be able to project ourselves as role models and give men an actual enriching lodge experience. To quote another movie, if you build it, they will come. Darren A. Lehners. All right, let's go ahead and hear now from illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison for this week's Masonic Minute.
Every Sunday school student knows Cain was the son of Adam and Eve. Beyond Cain, biblical genealogy is well defined, but not such common knowledge. For the record, the sons of the generations following Cain were Enoch, Irad, Mehujael, Methusael, and Lamech. Lamech was the first known polygamist. His first wife was Ada, and his second was Zillah, with whom he had a son and a daughter. Their daughter's name was Naamah. Naamah's brother was a man who gets sparse mention in the Masonic ritual, yet who is familiar to all Master Masons. His name was Tubal-Cain, an eighth generation descendant of Adam himself. So who was this man we've all heard about? There are several ideas about the origin of his name. Some believe the second part of his name merely suggests his lineage and the line of Adam's son Cain. Others claim the first part to be derived from Ybel, spelled Y-B-L, meaning to produce. The second part stems from the Aramaic Canaia, Q-A-I-N-A-Y-A, meaning metal worker. There are other suggested origins, but these seem most likely since they refer to his occupation, that of working with metals. Living up to his name, Tubal-Cain became a metal worker, forging tools out of bronze and iron. He is said, in fact, to have been the inventor of the forge, indicating he was the first skilled artificer in metals. The Bible also says he was an instructor of other metal craftsmen. Tubal-Cain's father, Lamech, was a follower of Cain's wicked and murderous ways. Genesis 4:23-24 tells us a young man committed a seemingly small offense against him, and Lamech not only killed him, but bragged about it to his wives. Knowing God marked Cain with a sign and promised 7 times vengeance on anyone who killed Cain for murdering Abel, Lamech boasted God would likewise protect him 70 times 7, a claim which, unlike with Cain, did not come from God, but from Lamech's bloated ego. Any vengeance upon the wicked sons of Cain, including Lamech, did not pass to Tubal-Cain, who significantly impacted history with his discovery in the art of metalworking. His cultural contributions are said, therefore, to be an illustration of the grace of God at work. Tubal-Cain, you might simply say, he was the 8th man from Adam and the first known artificer in metals. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, now the next piece I have for you this week comes from the Illinois Lodge of Research. This is from something they used to publish called the Bulletin. This is from October 9th of 1976. What is interesting about this is when it was still edited by Alphonse Thurza, who actually has a Philalethes chapter named after him as well. He was pretty prolific in the Masonic education in terms of research, that kind of stuff, back in the day, and certainly his stuff is still wonderful. We owe a lot to Alphonse Thurza, especially within the state of Illinois. So this one is called The Meaning of Masonic Research, but I'm going to continue reading past the bulletin just a little bit because he actually goes into some statistical analysis. He talks about the practical values of education, of Masonic education, that is, in a couple paragraphs. And then he has another section called What Are Masons Interested in Reading, which he goes over some of those highlights. And I think it's really interesting to see what people were interested in researching and what was Masonic education, quote-unquote, back then. So let's dive in and see what we can see and hear what we can hear. The Meaning of Masonic Research. Recently, we have been asked 2 questions by several of our members. 1, hasn't everything about Freemasonry been researched already? And 2, what need is there for Masonic research and also for a research lodge? These questions are asked because of a misunderstanding of the meaning of the word, quote-unquote, research in the field of Freemasonry. In ordinary matters, the word means the quest to discover something presently unknown that will solve an existing problem. A good illustration is the research going on to discover the cause of cancer. When the word research is used in connection with Freemasonry, it means the activity of rediscovering events, activities, facts, and meanings that will make a Mason better informed on matters relating to the craft. And no one will deny that an informed Mason is a better Mason. Why is Masonic research necessary to a better understanding of the craft? There are many reasons, and here are some of them. The first and foremost reason is to satisfy the inquiring minds of our members who have questions that need answering. Here are some illustrations of questions usually asked. Where and when did Freemasonry originate? How did Freemasonry come to Illinois? How many governors of Illinois have been Masons? What is the meaning of the word worshipful? Is the craft necessary in today's world? What does the craft have that it can offer to the youth of today? The answers to these questions require searching material from many places and sources and organizing the material in a logical form for presentation. The next reason is that learning about the past will give us pride in being members. Knowing what happened in the past within the craft will help us understand the present and teach us how to solve these problems. Another reason is that Freemasonry encourages its members to improve themselves. The quest for lost information, that can be told to our members will help in the process of improvement. The primary goal of the Illinois Lodge of Research is to bring to light facts relating to the history of the craft in Illinois, and it is hoped that eventually a complete and detailed history of the craft in our state can be published by our lodge. At the outset, it is necessary to recognize that our ritual is the foundation stone of our Masonic philosophy. There is no substitute for good ritualistic work, and emphasis on this thought is important. Masonic education is intended to pick up after the ritualistic work is completed, and the new member is exposed to a better understanding of what has taken place and the lessons that have been taught by the ceremonies of the degrees. Freemasonry is a vast and limitless subject, and there are many facets that remain to be researched and explored. A Mason's education does not end when he has received the three degrees, but a complete understanding of the lessons is of vital importance. There are many questions that exist in the minds of our members that need answering, and these answers ought to be supplied somehow. Many of these questions relate to the past. Some of them relate to the meaning of special Masonic words, and others relate to the great men who may have been members of the craft. It is hoped that the work of the Illinois Lodge of Research will find the answers to some of these questions and supply them to our members. The statement is sometimes made that the study of history is a waste of time because it places emphasis on looking back instead of ahead. If that is the purpose of studying Masonic history, then the charge would be worthy of attention. But the study of history is to help us understand the present and to help us prepare for the future. Whether we like it or not, the past is the basis for our present situation, feeling, and beliefs. We cannot ignore the past if we are to fully understand the present and prepare adequately for the future. It is surprising how the past blends into the present as we note that our Masonic ancestors were plagued with the same problems facing the craft today. Lack of attendance at the lodge meetings, declining membership at times, the use of chain letters, planning for good lodge programs, etc. Study of the past is also intended to give us pride in our heritage as we become familiar with the work that was done by the Masons of days gone by. It is also designed to help us better understand the nature of the craft, its work, and its vast and important contribution to the public welfare. Metaphorically, history is a lamp that sheds its light upon the present so that we can understand it better as we live today and prepare for tomorrow. It is also important that our members understand the organization of the craft, its laws, its purposes, and how it works, and the various projects that are being engaged in by the craft and its members. It is hoped that the Illinois Lodge of Research can shed some light on these subjects as time goes on. Being fully informed is vital for our members. Suppose a non-member asked you, what does your group have to offer to the youth of today? How would you answer this question unless you had some time to think about it so that you can answer it adequately and correctly? The facts and information we will be supplying our members ought to make it easy to answer such a question. A major reason for a research lodge is to disseminate information and news of interest. It is also important that a research lodge correct matters of misinformation that often is spread by well-meaning but ill-informed members. In our papers, we will be reproducing material that has been published elsewhere that will be of interest to our members. Research in this regard means finding items that are buried in Masonic periodicals that add something to our understanding and appreciation of the craft with special references to Illinois. As we find such material, it will be published for our members. Here are some illustrations of items that have been found and are passed to our members so that they may be better informed and make an advancement in their Masonic knowledge. In 1904, Standard Lodge No. 873 met in the Masonic Temple at Randolph and State Streets in Chicago on a Saturday afternoon and conferred the first section of the third degree on Dr. Arthur Smalley. The members then went to Thompson's Restaurant for supper. On returning to the building, they found police stationed in the lobby who informed the lodge officers that a meeting of a large group was forbidden above the third floor because of the loss of life several days earlier in the Iroquois Theater fire. The lodge did not reassemble for several weeks. At that time, the second section of the third degree was conferred on Dr. Smalley. During the period that he was waiting to receive the balance of the degree he was on, in effect, a 2.5-degree Mason, he became active in the lodge, and in 1916 he served the lodge as worshipful master. Later he moved to Hooperston, Illinois, and was a dentist for many years. On August 22, 1790, George Washington wrote a letter to King David's Lodge, No. 1 of Newport, Rhode Island, in which he said, quote, being persuaded that a just application of the principles on which the Masonic fraternity is founded must be promotive of private virtue and public prosperity, I shall always be happy to advance the interests of the society and to be considered by them as a deserving brother." End quote. As a bicentennial project, the Scottish Rite Bodies of Springfield had Dr. Wayne C. Temple research the subject of George Rogers Clark, and the information was given to Dr. Ottendorf, a nationally known artist who then painted a picture of George Rogers Clark. The original was formally presented to the state of Illinois and now hangs in the governor's mansion in Springfield. A copy of the picture also hangs in the Masonic Temple in Springfield. Another copy hangs in the high school in Freeport, Illinois, by virtue of Infeld, a student at the school, being the winner of the first prize in the Illinois Masonic Bicentennial High School Essay Contest in 1976. On January 15, 1875, King Kalakaua, a member of Progress of Oceanica Lodge of Honolulu, was a guest of Oriental Lodge No. 33 of Chicago, Illinois. We expect to cover the details of this visit in detail later on, possibly next year. On October 5, 1908, Faye Hampston of Colorado was crowned Poet Laureate of Freemasonry in Medina Temple, Chicago, Illinois, in a program sponsored by Ravenswood Lodge No. 777. This was the third time this honor was conferred. The first was on Robert Burns of Scotland, the second time was on Rob Morris of Kentucky by the Grand Lodge of New York. The dirge that is sung during a conferral of the third degree that starts with the word solemn strikes the funeral chime was written by Brother David Vinton, a teacher of the Masonic ritual and lecturer. The music is known as Pleyel's Hymn. Vinton was born on January 6, 1774 at Medford, Massachusetts, and he received his Masonic degrees in Vernon Lodge No. 4, Providence, Rhode Island in 1811. Most of his teaching activities took place in North and South Carolina. The original dirge was published in 1816 at Dedham, Massachusetts, in a volume called The Masonic Minstrel, and enjoyed immediate success. In 1821, he was expelled by the Grand Lodge of North Carolina for selling manuscripts with the Masonic lectures and for conferring the Mark and Pass Master degrees without authority, but his lodge came to his defense. Lionel Verbert, famous English Masonic author, has stated that the ritualistic references to the Golden Fleece and the Roman Eagle do not refer to the ancient objects, but rather to the operative era in the Masonic history. Therefore, the Golden Fleece refers to the Flemish wool merchants, and the Roman Eagle to the German Eagle of the Hanseatic League. It is a theory of interest. The word worshipful has a historical background. The Anglo-Saxon word worth, meaning something of value, something to be respected. The word ship is the old Teutonic word, which meant to create. The suffix full means to fill up. When these three words are used together as the word worshipful, it means a person who held a position which was honored and respected. This is the common title even used to this day in England. The word, as used in the craft, means worthy of respect. So I'll break into the piece here. What's happened is Cirza has kind of outlined what Masonic research is, what the hope of the Illinois Lodge of Research was to be, and you can kind of see even then what he was dealing with people likely questioning even the need for a Masonic Lodge of Research. And then, of course, he cuts them off at the pass in his quote at the top, where he says, you know, of course, nothing supersedes the ritual, right? This is a common thing that we always have to do. And then he gives several examples of some of the items that you might find in further issues. Now, as you go through Lodges of Research issues, for Illinois anyway, it goes from tidbits like this into full-blown articles and esoterica and everything else that you can imagine. But there was, for quite some time, some debate on what exactly was esoteric and even if it was appropriate for the Illinois Lodge of Research. In fact, for a time it was considered not appropriate, which is interesting. And so if we go into this additional section of the paper called What Are Masons Interested in Reading? Get a load of this. What Are Masons Interested in Reading? In April 1953 issue of the Illinois Enlightener, several questions were asked of the readers to indicate their interests. The results of the 2,380 answers received were printed in the 1954 issue of the magazine. Here is the tabulation of the replies. History, 39%. All subjects, 24%. Lodge activities, about 3.5%. Symbolism, 2%. Information, 2%. Educational, 1.64%. Explanatory, 1.17%. What came you here to do? 8.9%. And coming in with 1.17%, postage stamps. And then there were several items that are actually under 1% that are not listed. But I thought, wow, history, 40%. Okay, so I thought maybe the other 50% would be a mix of, practical and symbolism. Nope, symbolism, 2%. And postage stamps. I'm dumbfounded here. But just absolutely fascinating. As we think about Freemasonry and how we are all about education, and yet in 1976 anyway, we're reporting the results of something that was done in the 1950s in a Masonic publication for the state of Illinois, and it is insanity. So a future project of mine actually is to go after a copy, this issue of The Enlightener, and we're going to dig to the bottom of this a little bit. We're also going to go ahead and I'm going to get the member numbers for 1953. And we'll see what we can put together and discern a little bit more about this stuff. All right, now the last piece I have for you this week also comes from the Illinois Lodge of Research. This piece comes from the Bulletin of the Lodge of Research and is Volume 1, Number 3, Alphonse Cerza, still the editor. And the name of the piece, it's really interesting. It always catches my eye when I find these because I am in love with the ideas of world fairs and expositions. So this is called The Columbian Exposition of 1893 and Freemasonry by Alphonse Cerza. About a dozen years before the 400th anniversary of the discovery of America by Christopher Columbus, Dr. T.W. Zaremba, an American of the German extraction, started to campaign to make everyone aware of this milestone year in our history. He made the first formal suggestion for an exposition on June 11, 1884, and the following year he came to Chicago to confer about the matter with a number of persons. In 1886, he appeared before the American Historical Society in Washington and elaborated on the subject. On August 15, 1889, the Secretary of the State of Illinois issued a license to DeWitt Cregeer and others to form a corporation entitled the World's Exposition of 1892, with the object of holding an international exhibition or World's Fair in the city of Chicago to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the discovery of America. Steps were taken to communicate with the United States Senator Shelby M. Collum, requesting that he secure the cooperation of the United States government. On December 19th, Senator Collum introduced a resolution in the United States Senate that the government sponsor a World Exposition in 1893 to commemorate the 400th anniversary of Columbus discovering America. Although the matter had been suggested to him by persons from Illinois and Chicago, had been mentioned as the site of the exposition, he forgot to mention this in the resolution. As a result, competition to secure the exposition started among a number of cities. The leading competitors were New York, Washington, and St. Louis. A special congressional committee was formed to hold meetings to determine the selection of a city for the exposition. Chauncey M. Depew, a Mason, led the New York delegation before a committee. On January 11, 1890, DeWitt Cregeer, a Mason and then mayor of Chicago, and two other persons appeared before the committee on behalf of Chicago. Adlai E. Stevenson, the first, a Mason who was later to serve as Vice President of the United States, also appeared before the committee to support the selection of Chicago. On February 14, 1890, the Congress of the United States voted to have the exposition in Chicago. On April 25, 1890, President Benjamin Harrison approved the Act of Congress providing for an international exhibition of arts, industries, and manufacturers, and invited the nations of the world to take an active part. A national commission was appointed to supervise the plans, and many prominent men were enlisted to assure the success of the project. The Illinois legislature passed a law authorizing the city of Chicago to increase its bonded indebtedness $5 million to aid the exposition. Countries all over the world took part by erecting buildings, having exhibits, and presenting a variety of entertainments. The exposition was held in the area now occupied by the University of Chicago on the south side of Chicago. Saul Bloom, who was born in Pekin, Illinois, was the superintendent of construction of the exposition buildings. In 1903, he moved to New York and later became a famous congressman from that state. He was also a Mason. In October of 1892, dedicatory speeches were made at the site of the incompleted buildings where the exposition was to be held. The Columbian Exposition was formally opened on May 1, 1893. Of special interest to us as Masons, there are two matters connected with the exposition: the erection of the new Masonic Temple and the holding of a Masonic Congress during the exposition. The new Masonic Temple erected. The idea of the building of a new Masonic Temple was conceived by Norman T. Gassett. In the year 1890, he called together a group of Masonic leaders to discuss the matter, and he became the guiding spirit of the project. He was born on April 21, 1839 in Townsend, Vermont, and his family moved to Chicago in 1849. On June 17, 1861, he joined Company A of the 19th Illinois Volunteer Infantry and served in the Civil War with distinction until October of 1864. He attained the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. Upon his return to Chicago, he attended the University of Chicago Law School, became a lawyer, and served in a number of public offices as a leading Republican. In addition to being a lawyer, he was a mortgage banker and had many other business interests. He joined Blair Lodge No. 393 and later affiliated with Home Lodge No. 508. He became active in the York Rite and also in the Scottish Rite, receiving his 33rd degree in 1889. At the time of his death on March 26, 1891, he was serving as the president of the Masonic Fraternity Temple Association, the company that was erecting the new Masonic Temple. Five locations were considered as the site for the new Masonic Temple, but finally it was agreed to buy the land at the northeast corner of State and Randolph Streets in Chicago. The land was bought from various owners for a total of $1,200 and was assembled by Gassett and the titles cleared by him. A company had been formed to raise $2 million, the estimated cost of the project. Later, another $1.5 million had to be raised by bond issue to complete the erection of the building. Daniel H. Burnham and John Wellborn Root were selected as the architects to design and supervise the construction. The cornerstone was laid on November 6, 1890. At noon, an occasional communication of the Grand Lodge of Illinois was opened by John M. Pearson, Grand Master at the Asylum of Apollo Commandery. Later, a parade was formed and marched to the northeast corner of Randolph and State Streets. Approximately 4,000 persons in 37 lodges took part in the parade, together with 600 Knights Templar and 85 members of Oriental Consistory. The cornerstone was laid with the customary Masonic ceremony. The Grand Orator, DeWitt Cregeer, who was then mayor of Chicago, gave the official oration. The Grand Lodge returned to the Asylum of Apollo Commandery and was closed in proper form. That evening, of the prominent persons present was Morris Goldwater of Arizona, grandfather of the present-day Senator Barry Goldwater. Carter H. Harrison, who had served as mayor of Chicago, was present and spoke. He was not a Mason, but his son, by the same name, who later served five terms as mayor of Chicago, was a Mason. Construction of the new Masonic Temple started at once. The last stone was laid in place on November 1, 1891. The new Masonic Temple was the engineering marvel of the age. The location had been a swamp, and a special type of foundation had to be laid to support what was to become the tallest building in the world, 320 feet high with 21 stories. It had 11 elevators that ran to the observatory on the top floor, from where one could see the entire city on a clear day. The building had a steel frame bolted together with stone and brick concrete floors, and terracotta partitions with ample stone and marble trim. It was the first fireproof building to be constructed. The building could accommodate 100,000 people at one time. For the first time in any building, hot and cold water was installed in each room. There was a chute on each floor for mailing letters. Part of the building was used for Masonic purposes, floors 17 and 18, two-thirds of the 19th and one-third of the 20th. There was a commandery room, a reading room, and an oriental hall with a seating capacity of 500 persons. The balance of the building was rented to tenants for various business purposes. In the basement, there were 5,000 safety deposit boxes with a special room set aside for use by the ladies. When the ground was being excavated, there was discovered a large metal ball with holes on the outside resembling a sponge. Many theories were founded by learned scientists as to the origin of the item. They had a field day until a local resident remembered that a hardware store was located on the first floor of the building before the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. Further examination of the item disclosed that the item was a mass of melted metals that had been in the store. This object at present is in the possession of the Chicago Historical Society and has a suitable marker explaining what it is and where it was found. On November 6, 1891 at noon, an occasional communication of the Grand Lodge of Illinois was convened in the preceptory of Oriental Consistory with John Corson Smith as proxy of the Grand Master. A parade was formed on Michigan Avenue and Congress Street of about 2,000 persons who marched to the location of the new temple. A stand was erected in front of the building. The capstone was covered with an American flag, and with suitable ceremony, the stone was raised to the top of the building by a crane. Several speakers presented suitable remarks from the speaker's stand to the large crowd assembled there. With the passing years, the building encountered financial troubles, and gradually, its use as a Masonic temple ended. The beautiful, unique building was torn down around the year 1939. The Masonic Congress, August 14th through the 18th, 1893. The idea of holding a Masonic Congress during the Columbian Exposition started when the Grand Lodge of Kentucky adopted a resolution stating that it was in favor of joining with other Grand Lodges of the world in holding a fraternal Congress in Chicago during the World's Fair for the sole purpose of interchanging fraternal sentiments concerning the general interests of the craft. It was especially noted that this would have a greater uniformity in the modes of recognition and the fundamental features which characterized the craft the world over. When this resolution was called to the attention of the Grand Lodges, some interest was displayed. Accordingly, the Grand Master appointed a committee of the Fraternal Congress consisting of Joseph Robbins, DeWitt C. Cregeer, and John Corson Smith, later Loyal L. Munn and Leroy A. Goddard, were added to the committee. An executive committee was appointed for the purpose of entertaining the delegates, with the following persons serving therein: D.C. Cregeer, John Corson Smith, Daniel J. Avery, Joseph H. Dixon, and William K. Forsyth. The sum of $5,000 was appropriated for the expense of the Congress. The meeting of the Fraternal Congress was opened on August 14, 1893, in the Preceptory of Oriental Consistory of the new Masonic Temple by Monroe C. Crawford, the Grand Master of Masons in Illinois. The Grand Lodge in the United States were represented, plus the Indian Territory, some Grand Lodges of Canada, and the Grand Lodges of England, Ireland, Scotland, New South Wales, and Germany. The committee on the program listed 12 subjects that were to be discussed. 1. Ancient landmarks. What are they? 2. Appeal for the aid from sojourning brethren and incidental to this question, begging circulars. 3. Candidates. Physical qualifications. 4. Correspondence between Grand Lodges and Lodges, Foreign Grand Lodge Officers, Members of Lodges with Grand Lodges and Grand Officers, through whom conducted. 5. Entered apprentices. Are they Masons? Should conferring that degree confer membership? Otherwise, does not conferring the Master's degree confer membership? Should not the original practice of Masonry, of transacting business on the first degree, be restored? 6. Non-affiliation. How shall the evil be lessened, and incidentally, the rights of non-affiliations. 7. Grand Masters, powers and prerogatives. 8. Jurisdiction over candidates, elected or rejected. Is it perpetual or limited? 9. Proceedings of Grand Lodges, size, uniformity, etc., and to whom distributed. 10. Can officers resign? If not, why? 11. Vouching. Is it even lawful? 12. Can a regular lodge make a clandestine Mason? At the conclusion of the Fraternal Congress, 10 general conclusions were announced by the group. These were not intended to be binding on anyone, but were merely stated as the beliefs of those persons present at the meeting. Well, there you have that piece as well. Now, perhaps in a future installment, we can get the conclusions of the Fraternal Congress, and we can go through those a little bit and talk about those. But that is it for this week. I want to thank you all for joining me once more on this Masonic journey that we have called Whence Came You. You know, as we've been doing this program since July of 2011, we have 450 50 episodes almost here coming up. It's all brought to you by the producers of the show. So whether you're a contributor, a fellow, or a producer, I just want to thank you guys one more time before we leave out on this week. You can also make a one-time gift if you're interested in any of that. Please head on over to WCYpodcast.com, and you can find all the details there under Support the Show. Our supporters, past and present, if you click on the supporters, and you'll find a list there of all of the people who have helped support this show, and to those people, a extra thank you. If you would love to read more about the Illinois Lodge of Research and the transactions of the past, present, and future, I would highly recommend you head on over to IllinoisLodgeOfResearch.com and check out some of the membership requirements, download the stuff, send some emails around, and go ahead and join us. I'm sure Brother Tim Longfellow will be happy to process your membership. He's a great guy and a wonderful mason. That's it for this week. Until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.